The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News and World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We are about to talk with Richard Santos. Rick Santos is the president and CEO of IMA World Health that has projects across the globe based out of here in Maryland. And Rick and others in his organization were buried under the rubble at the Hotel Montana.
That's right.
In Port-au-Prince, Haiti for 50 hours. And Rick, welcome. Good to have you back.
Mark, thanks. I'm very happy to be here.
I'm sure you are. I mean, I know as we many people called when the moment they heard and everyone wanted to talk to you and the others, and of course you had a lot to recover from in coming back. But now that you have sort of recovered, is it a tough thing to ever recover from completely?
Yeah.
To talk a bit about what happened that day to you all in Haiti.
Yeah. Well, Mark, we were actually in Haiti. I was there with two other colleagues from IMA, Dr. Sarla Chand, who heads up our international programs, and Anne Varghese, who is our program officer for our Haiti programs. We implement a USAID funded through RTI International a grant to address neglected tropical diseases, specifically lymphatic filariasis,
which is
essentially elephantitis. It's a disease of the skin, huge inflammation. The fact that Haiti is, you know, one of the countries that has this disease existing tells you a little bit about the situation there. So we were there for a 3-day consultation with some of the other implementing partners, the donors. In fact, the Minister of Health was he opened up the meeting that morning, and there's several other ministry officials who were there who are responsible for this program. That meeting went it was supposed to be 3 days, Tuesday to Thursday, and we had finished up the first day of meetings around 4 p.m. We then decided to meet some other colleagues of ours from the United Methodist Committee on Relief, or UMCOR. Reverend Sam Dixon, Reverend Clint Rabb, and Reverend Jim Gully. Mm-hmm. UMCOR is on IMA's board, a member of IMA, and in fact, Sam Dixon is on my board. So they do a lot of work globally. They would do a lot of work in Haiti. And the purpose of our meeting was just to kind of look at things that we could do together more collaboratively. They met us at about 5 minutes to 5, kind of packed up our laptops and trying to get that last email out. And as we were beginning to walk through the lobby, we heard a rumble. By the time my mind got around the word earthquake, the entire building had collapsed upon us. I had previously been in a smaller earthquake in Indonesia when I lived there, and I remember that also fairly vividly. I remember shaking and seeing things sway, and I remember I had time to really actually walk to a door frame or walk someplace to somehow get to a more safe location. I'm not sure that would have helped me in this situation because the entire lobby was just completely under slobs of concrete.
So the earthquake happened. The hotel falls down around you all.
Yes.
And then you were stuck in a smaller space, and for how long?
We were stuck in a space approximately 8 foot wide by 5 foot long and about 3 foot high. I remember, and there was five of us. There were six in our group. Five of us were in that space. And our other colleague, Sarla Chand, was actually thrown to another small space just next to us. But we actually couldn't see her because she was behind all this rubble and debris.
Could you hear her?
We could hear her. We made it's funny. I was talking to the other two colleagues just the other day. For the first time, we were all sitting together. And Anne said, Rick, the first thing you did was you grabbed my arm and asked me if I was okay. So I didn't recall that. But the first thing we did was just to make contact with everybody. Who's here? Are we okay? What's going on? Two of our colleagues, the two gentlemen from UMCOR, Reverend Rabb and Reverend Dixon, were unfortunately pinned under a fair amount of debris. Reverend Dixon had a large concrete piece, probably the size of a I don't know, a large chair just mm-hmm. sitting on his legs. And Clint had a more of a kind of a pile of rubble pinning his legs down and crushing them. After the initial shock, the fact that everyone was still alive and was just a miracle. I mean, I don't know how to explain that. Pure dumb luck. We were just happened to be. If we had tried to run in another direction, we might have been crushed immediately and killed. So the fact that we all six of us made it was really pretty amazing. And then we immediately tried to do is try to make the other guys comfortable, see if we could do anything to help them with their situation. But really, there was nothing we could do with their legs. If we had moved the rubble, I think that would have done more damage. And so that initial shock, we pulled out cell phones and things like that to create light. Sarla had no light. Her purse and everything was kind of thrown away. So she was completely in the dark. And, you know, at that moment, we were all alive. And I think we all started talking about, okay, what do we need to do to survive, to get rescued? And we try to talk to each other, calm each other down. And I have to say, you know, that first night, it was really around 55 hours. But that very first night, we mm-hmm. knew we weren't going to be rescued. It was too quickly. The earthquake happened at 5. Rescues usually happen during the day. You know, we knew that it had to be communicated, and then there had to be teams to come in. So
and your cell phones were not working.
No cell phone signal, no wireless signal. Right. In fact, what saved us, I believe, at that moment was we were right walking through the lobby next to the front desk. So when we were thrown to the ground and the huge ceiling slab of concrete that landed on top of us also landed on the front desk, and it was a heavy wood desk and crushed it. But there was enough of it left to hold that 3-foot space up for us.
So yeah. I'm just imagining, because everybody imagined this when this yeah. happened, the people, the, you know, the Haitians and the
yes.
and the others in Haiti who when this happened and were stuck. And so yeah. it's always hard for all of us to imagine what we would have done, what would have felt like if we were stuck in this small space and not being clear whether or not you would be rescued or not.
Yeah.
And after a day and a half of being there.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there was a lot of things that happened. I mean, that first night, you know, at some point you hear these phantom sounds. And at one point we started banging and we started yelling. And then we actually heard a sound, and we communicated. There was a guy named Dan who was in the elevator shaft. He was the guy that was on the news about the iPod, you know, with the first aid. So we were immediately in contact with him. He was in contact with another Haitian gentleman who was trapped. So we were all communicating together, and we checked in with them every hour just to make sure they were okay and so forth. So we went the whole night, and that morning, probably around 9 o'clock, we heard something. We heard some thumping, and we thought it was two people with maybe a sledgehammer just looking for pockets. And we saw that we heard it very methodically, like we heard it over here and then we heard it over, you know, kind of going on a line, trying to make a line, a path of things. And we started banging on the pillar next to us and yelling help and help and help. And it was two gentlemen who were Haitian, because they had a French Creole accent. And they said to us, "How many are you?" And we're 8, and our 6 in the 2
in
the elevator.
Did any of you speak Creole?
We had a couple French speakers. So, and then they asked, "Are you okay?" And we said, "No, we're hurt." Now, I've been in the humanitarian field for nearly 20 years. And so in these types of situation, what you hope somebody would do is stay in communication with you, give you instruction, just to give you a sense. And then you kind of have expectations. But that day, we don't know what happened to them. And maybe they helped locate us or not, but they went away and nobody ever came back that day.
Oh, my God.
So so this was 9 in the morning. Like, they'll be back by noon. Noon rolled around because we had our watches and we were mm-hmm. watching the time. Nothing. And then, you know, 5 p.m. rolled around. And we're like, oh, no, it's starting to get dark. And we could also during that first day hear helicopters flying back and forth and very distant sounds, so we don't know how far they were because they were vibrating and so forth through all that concrete. And that night was pretty dark, I think, for all of us, Mark. I mean, that was the first moment. My sense of, I think we can survive long enough for somebody to find us, but that night was really, I'm not sure I'm going to make it. And I have two young boys, and so that was just a really beginning to think about my life or their life without me, and was really a kind of, I think all of us were kind of in that moment of reflection. And the two friends who were injured were definitely getting worse, and you could see that. In my bag, I had some Aleve, and so we were giving them something to kind of comfort them. But so we went that night, and that was a real difficult night. And so it's now Thursday morning, and so we're again thinking, you know, maybe something will happen today. And again, we hear helicopters, and you know, at first the first day we heard helicopters, like that's a sign of rescue. And then the second day we're like, that's a sign of somebody flying over us. But we heard more helicopters. We heard some distant sounds, and really we went through that day thinking somebody might make contact with us. And so that day was also a very long day. And again, our colleagues were really starting to get worse. And we were, I think, really in a lot of trepidation about that next night. So it rolled around 5 o'clock.
Oh.
And
third night.
Beginning the third night. And, it got a lot of play in the media, but I did have one – literally the only thing we had to eat or drink was the lollipop that I have I always have to bribe my kids when they need them to stop crying or do something. And we shared that. Sarla, who was in the other compartment, was really interesting. She found out, because she was in complete darkness, she found that she could move around a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so she ended up, we heard her, and she says, Rick, I'm going to go over here. And I'm like, Sarla, you know, be careful. Don't hurt yourself. Let me know, you know, what you're doing. And so that Thursday afternoon, she started kind of finding ways to move about her compartment. She found some openings. At one point, we heard her bang in Sarla's 65, and you know, a strong-willed woman. She was we could hear her pounding a stone on these things. She goes, "I see some lights, or I see something, and I'm gonna try to make this opening bigger." And so she was hitting it, and we hear this pounding going on, and oh, it caved in.
Oh.
And so I mean, it was all of that just emotional kind of up and down. And we're like, Sarla, don't hurt yourself. You know, we're already into this. You know, we're already 40 plus hours into this. Don't hurt yourself. Don't overextend yourself. You know, she had no water or food. Oh, my goodness. So it was getting to be about 6 o'clock that Thursday night. And I'd pretty much given up hope for that night. Just again, rescues happen, especially in this type of complicated debris. We didn't know what kind of teams were there. We thought somebody was coming with literally going to come with sledgehammers and some type of pickaxe or something to we didn't know what was going to happen, how long it would take. But you know, it gets dark and rescues people have to be careful. They don't want to disturb the rubble, so. It's moving in 6 o'clock that Thursday night, and I wasn't sure whether my friends were going to make it another night. I thought those of us who were relatively uninjured, we all had really severe bumps and bruises, cuts and scrapes and so forth. We thought we could probably hold on for maybe 2 more days or so. But around 7 o'clock that Thursday night, Sarla goes, "I hear voices. I really hear voices." And we started banging. Like, I mean, there's like a kind of a wood pillar that's kind of part of the, if you look at the pictures of the Hotel Montana,
mm-hmm.
For the lobby, there's these little square lights and next to them are kind of these pillars. And literally we were in a piece of that section. We're banging on the pillars. We're shouting, "Help, help, help." Sarla could say there's a little hole that she could see to the outside, see lights. And around 7 o'clock, which was around the 50 hour mark, we hear a voice come back to us saying, "We're here. We're French firemen, and we're here to rescue you." Oh, my goodness. And so, I mean, and then I think we were on adrenaline after that. I mean,
yeah.
It took them another 5 hours to get us out. Actually, more than that. For me, it was 5 hours. Sarla was out first. She was in the outer compartment. And then we couldn't quite fit through the initial part. So I went out next. Then Jim Gully, and then they widened it a little bit. And then while Ann was in there, they actually sent 2 medical doctors. And in fact, Jim Gully forwarded me an article in the French newspaper just 2 days ago about what happened to Sam and Clinton. We didn't actually know ultimately what happened. But so they actually climbed in. The doctors climbed into that little compartment and started giving medical care to our friends. But to get me out of that, I had to slide out on my back. And they were kind of – I was writhing and they were pulling me by my ankles. And it was still – the concrete was right against my belly. And so – you know, and that was the one, and that was almost like a 2-foot bit of concrete. And that was after all the rubble was cleared. They cut away the metal and they moved some things. And then I had to go out again through another small opening. And then they put me on a stretcher and then they carried me out. I mean, we were fairly close to the front of the building. They carried me out up a mound of rubble and through a hole. And as they're carrying me in the stretcher, and I'm looking up behind me as we're going down, I could see like almost like a car jack, something that you raise a car on. So this hole was basically above it was this just huge piece of concrete, a slab that they had jacked up so they could pull people out. My heart goes out to the French rescuers who helped us. There was also some folks from Fairfax County, Virginia, who were on the scene who gave us medical treatment. The USAID people were there. As soon as they kind of cleared us medically initially, I could call my wife on the sat phone. But really, wow, it was. It was really it's hard for me to just to talk about it still.
So did you lose any people there? You did, didn't you?
We did. Sam and Clint did not make it. In our hearts, we all felt we kind of were all going to get out. And as soon as we saw those rescuers and medical attention really getting to these gentlemen, that they would be out. But the article in the French paper basically said Sam died of cardiac arrest in the space after initial treatment. What I heard was Clint was his feet were amputated and they got him to Florida, a medical evacuation by helicopter to Florida, and he was in a coma, but then ultimately didn't make it. So we're still mourning their loss.
I'm sure you are. It's a very serious thing you all went through.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the important things I think that I know that you feel in all this is that two things, but the most important is about the Haitian people.
Absolutely.
And what's going on in Haiti, because we are so – it's so easy for us to see the headlines and have this rush about watching the headlines, and then it's gone.
Yeah.
But the Haitians are still living through what they're living through.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, emergencies like this have different phases, and really the first phase is rescue, trying to find as many people alive as possible. Then you begin then to transition into a recovery phase and then a long-term rebuilding phase. And, you know, that's going to go on for a decade. And in my organization, IMA World Health, is committed to that. We are a faith-based organization. A lot of we have 12 members, including a lot of the big mainline denominational churches and organizations.
Protestant,
Lutheran World Relief, Episcopal Relief and Development, Church World Service, Disciples of Christ, UCC, Mennonite Central Committee, Presbyterian Church USA, ADRA, LWR, Lutheran World Relief. So we really have a lot of organizations that do the first responder piece of it, which we're actually supplying. We've supplied over three-quarters of $1 million worth of medical supplies thus far for this first phase. But we're already looking at – we're sending a team in there to look at how we can continue the NTD work and try to build on that. I mean, you know, Haiti is a very interesting country. It was one of the poorest countries in the Western – it is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, one of the poorest countries in the world. In some interesting ways, it was turning a corner in terms of the violence and the political situation. There was an election coming up our staff was talking about when we were there, and they were hopeful. They felt that there would be a lot less violence than before. But this earthquake has really kind of destroyed everything. In some areas, it's kind of interesting. I look at Indonesia after the tsunami. The Banda Aceh was basically a rebellion, area of rebellion for the Indonesian government. And the GOM, who were the rebel units, actually the tsunami created a very interesting space for them to actually have a peace negotiation and a peace agreement, which hadn't been the case for decades and decades. And in some ways, I'm hoping that Haiti has an opportunity to really look at its future and build it. You know, we're committed to that in terms of the health piece. We're committed to doing it with Haitians, not coming in and telling them what to do, but helping them
That's
figure
important.
That out themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big part of it. And I want to just say something else about Sam. You know, when we were in there, and Sam Dixon, who's an amazing person with the Methodist Church, he, you know, there are several times where we all sat together and we prayed, and Sam led it. I mean, he's a man who's injured under the rubble. And the first thing he said is, for our prayers first go out to Haiti and the Haitian people and the people who we know are in a worse situation. I mean, he was amazing that way. And so,
people of deep faith are amazing, aren't
yes.
they?
Yes. Oh, my goodness. And, yeah, his commitment right. is unparalleled in a lot of ways. But, yeah, so from that moment, we were committed to working in Haiti and to the suffering that's going on there. You know, a lot of the media are already beginning to pull out. This is, you know, the stories is beginning to change.
Right.
But, you know, this will be a decades-long process. And we just hope people will and that's what I'm hoping my story will help people do is think that through and really commit to that.
Well, what we want to commit to here, of course, is hearing much more about your work over the coming months. Over the coming months, doing our shows about Haiti on a more consistent basis. We've done many in the past, but yeah. Talk to Lavaris and our friends who are in Haiti doing work they're doing there and stay in touch with them and even some upbeat shows about Haiti to have Edward Dantacat and others on to talk about the great culture of Haiti. That people forget the sister, what
yes.
also is there, and want to hear a great deal more about your work with the IMA.
Well, we'd love to tell you more as we move forward with this. You know, Haiti is a wonderful place, and it will continue to be that as it rebuilds. And I mean, the spirit of the Haitian people is quite amazing. You know, you heard a few stories of the looting and so forth, and. But I think that was really, really a very
right.
small part. I mean, it was really the opposite. It was people reaching out to help each other. That's
Some of
really
our media blew
happened.
That up, and it was just the opposite, as you were saying,
yeah.
with most Haitians who were just there to help one another. And
That's
they
right.
were resilient, amazing people.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Rick Santos, I'm glad you're with us, and that you're, as president and CEO of IMA World Health, doing all this incredible work around the world. And I'm glad you're a Maryland-based group, and I'm glad you're safe. And thank you for coming in today.
Mark, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, Public Radio WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at mecu.com.